It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We're going to talk about the latest news in the security world and then start to dissect how Internet of Things devices work and how insecure they are. That's why he says they're in their infancy. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 562, recorded Tuesday, May 31st, 2016. IoT Infancy, Part 1. Security Now is brought to you by Varidesk. Varidesk easily converts your existing desk or cubicle into a standing desk, so you can switch between sitting and standing to stay fit and active at work. Learn more at Varidesk.com. That's V-A-R-I-D-E-S-K.com. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover the latest security news. We help you protect yourself online, help you become an expert who can help your friends and family and those people around you. People who listen to Security Now not only are safer themselves, but make sure that their loved ones are safer, too. So this is a show you have to listen to. Steve Gibson is here, the explainer-in-chief. He makes it all possible. Hello, Steve.
Yo, Leo. Great to be with you again for episode 562.
Yipes.
As we close in on the end of our 11th year of this never-ending quest for security.
In 11 years, the one thing I've never asked you, in 11 years, you'd think this would be the kind of thing one buddy would ask another, spaces or tabs? Only silicon. I got a dead silence when I asked Andy Anako and Renee Ritchie.
They hadn't seen
Silicon Valley yet. That's why I have to, you know, Lisa goes to bed because it's late. After Game of Thrones, she goes to bed. But I say, honey, I have to stay up because part of my job is knowing what happens in Silicon Valley and Veep.
That's right.
And let's face it, John Oliver as well.
Yeah.
So that's part of my research Sunday night. I'm stuck in front of the glued in front of the tube.
Yep, I have. You remember, as our listeners know, I'm still coding. All of the code that I write is in a DOS box in a
do you use Brief? What do you use?
I use Brief.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Brief actually has its roots in Emacs. It was some guys that were Unix people that originally created Brief sort of in the image. And so there is a Lisp-like language which actually glues it together. So, I mean, it's a completely programmable editor. The Brief is an acronym that involves – R is reconfigurable. So it's like interactive – reconfigurable editor, blah blah, you know, programmers, I don't know what it was, but there was an acronym, and it was a company called Underwear.
I remember that, it. Yeah.
Yep.
Only hardcore people
use
Brief.
Dave somebody, I can't quite get his name.
It's
but
gone
anyway.
Though, right? I mean, they don't make it anymore.
Oh yeah, that's that the it got bought the Brief got sold to someone, but you know, it still works. But the point is that I was also a devout WordStar user, and so one of the things that I did is to completely reconfigure the keyboard mapping so that it uses WordStar keystrokes, where you hold the control down with your pinky, and of course the control key is where it was meant to be, immediately to the left of the A.
Yes.
Not caps lock. It's
but
like,
that's what I do the first time I – and again, any new machine, the first thing I do is I remap caps lock to control.
Exactly.
Because otherwise I'm going to be typing at y'all in caps sooner or later.
Right.
They call it Emacs finger, by the way. Your Emacs pinky. From
yes.
A little overuse. Because yes. Emacs, everything's a caps key, control keystroke.
Right. So anyway, the point is that so not only does Brief know about WordStar keystrokes, but then I created a superset of those. For example, I have one key. Actually, it's Control I that a great programming friend of mine came up with that is so useful. He hadn't ever seen it anywhere, but it was implemented back in the 80s on an Innerdata mini computer, and it pulls the character down from the line above. And it turns out it's just so handy to have that. So I adopted that in Brief. So I have that. But also, for example, I have one that immediately cleans up the file. It removes any white space from the end of lines. So I can do that. And it says, oh, four lines were cleaned up. It's like, fine. You know, where you just sort of have some spaces at the end of something that are obviously not important. And so this removes them. And, of course, there's a tabification, which is where I was coming with this, is that if there's ever more than eight spaces in a row, it says, you know, tisk, 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 and it replaces them where it can. It removes them and puts tabs in order to, of course, reduce the source file size.
Really missed out, though. If you were using the one true editor, you would be able to do all of that and so much more. And you wouldn't even have to. I can't believe Brief Pro is $120. Emacs is free on every platform. But that's okay. That's okay.
I paid for mine 30 years ago.
I know, you got your money's worth.
And I actually live in it every day.
You got your money's worth. The problem with Emacs, and this is really the truth, is it is so infinitely configurable. It really isn't an editor. It's just a framework that you never get any work done because you're so busy changing your, you know, fixing the UI and making
that's the problem with object-oriented languages.
Yeah.
Is that many the programmers get so caught up in expressing the problem in the language that it's like, okay, great. You know, you've got this fabulous object hierarchy design now, which beautifully represents the problem. Have you solved it? Well, no. But boy, as soon as we actually write some code, it's going to be amazing.
It's going to be amazing. It's like, so first we have to set it all up.
Yeah.
Just so. I'm working on the header files. I'll be done soon. Control KS, save that, and we'll move on to the news of the week.
Yep. So, yeah, lots to talk about. We're going to talk about the Burr-Feinstein encryption bill, the outcome of the Oracle-Google fight, Google's pressure to increase updates of Android in the field. I got a lot of tweets about the news of a company called Blue Coat obtaining an intermediate CA certificate from Symantec. Some news about from some security research, insecurity of laptop add-on bloatware of various kinds. Last week, we ran out of time, and I didn't get a chance to talk about what's been going on with Squirrel, and so we're gonna do that. And I had promised to talk about a report that Rapid7 Security did when they looked closely at internet connected baby monitors. Well, it turns out that when I laid everything out, there was just so much to talk about that I thought, okay. I mean, I wanted to talk. I ran across other information about IoT stuff, and so I named this podcast IoT Infancy. But this ended up being part one of that topic. So we have so much to talk about that I just realized we wouldn't be able to do it justice, and I wanted to. So next week we will do part two, where we'll deal with all of the crazy security news that has transpired since then and wrap up this topic by looking at some really frightening details of what Rapid7 found. But this week's first part coverage is sort of the meta view of it, because there's some interesting other things that I found that sort of leads us into the look at the details that I know our listeners will find really interesting. So lots to do. And at the very end, so that our security focused people don't have to listen to it. A lot of our listeners have asked for what's going on with this whole Seraphos, Enerphos ingredient of the healthy sleep formula. So I promised to move it to the very end so people can say, okay, fine, stop. and then not have to listen to any of that. Although, frankly, 1,700 people a day are now visiting the Healthy Sleep Formula page, and it's become a thing. So I need to give it a little bit of time, and I don't have anywhere else to do that other than here, so we'll just stick it at the end so people can say, okay, not for me, stop. So, Burr Feinstein, the good news is it met a quick and swift and complete death in the Senate. Reuters had some great coverage and uncovered some little tidbits that I don't think we would have known about otherwise. The way they expressed it was they said after a rampage that – talking about the San Bernardino rampage, the rampage that left 14 people dead in San Bernardino – key U.S. lawmakers pledged to seek a law requiring technology companies to give law enforcement agencies a, quote, backdoor, whatever that means. And we've talked about how ill-defined important terms are, unfortunately. But, you know, so for whatever that means, to encrypted communications and electronic devices, such as the iPhone used by one of the shooters. Now, they wrote, only months later, much of the support is gone and the push for legislation dead, according to sources in congressional offices, the administration, and the tech sector. Draft legislation that Senators Richard Burr and Dianne Feinstein, the Republican and Democratic leaders of the Intelligence Committee, had circulated weeks ago likely will not be introduced this year. And even if it were, would stand no chance of advancing, these sources said. The other little tidbits that I pulled out of a much longer coverage was that the short life of the push for legislation illustrates the intractable nature of the debate over digital surveillance and encryption, which has been raging in one form or another since the 1990s. What I didn't know was that the CIA and NSA were ambivalent, meaning, okay, but we know that the FBI wasn't, but the CIA and NSA were, according to several current and former intelligence officials, wrote Reuters, in part because officials in those agencies feared any new law would interfere with their own encryption efforts. So they wanted things to sort of be left alone. They were like, we have to be very careful with what we do here if we implement any new legislation. And they all, Reuters also wrote that half a dozen people familiar with the White House deliberations said they were hamstrung by a long-standing split within the Obama administration, which pitted Comey and the DOJ against technology advisors and other agencies, including the Commerce and State Departments. And then finally, they said there was reluctance to take on the tech industry in an election year, which I thought was interesting. So, you know, yes, the tech industry does have power. And this really does sound like the huge reaction that occurred in the tech sector, which was very vocal among both professional cryptographers, you know, and everything that we covered, the EFF and the all of the letters, you know, signed by the who's who of technology and cryptography, really did serve to put the brakes on this. And if nothing else, just it's like, well, we can't deal with that now. So, you know, I mean, it died just completely and totally, which is really a good sign. It's like not alive in any form any longer. So, yay.
The greatest virtue really in our system of government is that it moves incredibly slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's just really impossible to get anything done.
I'm often glad now that I'm 61, so because, you know, they won't be able to screw it up that badly.
You're safe for the next 40
years. I figure in the time I have left. Yeah. Yeah, and it does move slowly.
Yeah.
So
yeah. So any big change like that, I'm really curious. I bet you it is. I think you're right that it's probably the lobbying of the tech industry that had the most impact on this.
The feeling I got from reading Reuters coverage was that there was enough. You know, I don't want to use the word FUD, you know, because that's famously, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. But arguably, the politicians don't understand the technology, and so the technologist said, this is impossible. What you want is impossible. And I would argue, and everyone has heard me argue, that's not true. But it turned out to be great that that's what got said, because it, like, the politicians who don't know one way or the other said, maybe it is. I mean, but, you know, the smart people are saying we can't do this, even though we don't know why. So maybe we shouldn't. Yeah, so that was good. Also, there was another good piece of news, and that is that I think it was Thursday of last week, so a couple of days after our coverage last week of the whole Oracle-Google API mess, after 3 days of deliberation, the two-week-long trial concluded with the jury unanimously deciding in Google's favor that Google's use of the API fell under the umbrella, sort of the get-out-of-jail-free card of copyright law of fair use. And so, of course, Oracle immediately vowed to appeal. Oracle's general counsel, Dorian Daley, in a written statement said, "We strongly believe that Google developed Android by illegally copying core Java technology to rush into the mobile device market." Oracle brought this lawsuit to put a stop to Google's illegal behavior. No, they'd like to have $9 million, please, because, you know, Google did what Oracle failed to do. Anyway, that's me editorializing. Dorian said, "We believe there are numerous grounds for appeal, and we plan to bring this case back to the Federal Circuit on appeal." And, you know, observers suspect that they will. Now, I was a little curious about, okay, what exactly is fair use? And so I found a nice little piece at Stanford Law that sort of explained it a little bit. Stanford Law wrote, "In its most general sense, a fair use is any copying of copyrighted material done for a limited and transformative purpose, such as to comment upon, criticize, or parody a copyrighted work. Such uses can be done without permission from the copyright owner. In other words, fair use is a defense against a claim of copyright infringement. If your use qualifies as a fair use, then it would not be considered an illegal infringement." So Stanford continues saying, "So what is a transformative use? If this definition seems ambiguous or vague, be aware that millions of dollars in legal fees have been spent attempting to define what qualifies as a fair use. There are no hard and fast rules, only general rules and varied court decisions, because the judges and lawmakers who created the fair use exception did not want to limit its definition. Like free speech, they wanted it to have an expansive meaning that could be open to interpretation." So Stanford said most fair use analysis falls into two categories: commentary and criticism, or parody. And of course, this would fall under commentary, and essentially commentary. And so Stanford said, if you are commenting upon or critiquing a copyrighted work, for instance, writing a book review, fair use principles allow you to reproduce some of the work to achieve your purposes, which is where Google is. Some examples of commentary and criticism include quoting a few lines from a Bob Dylan song in a music review, summarizing and quoting from a medical article on prostate cancer in a news report, copying a few paragraphs from a news article for use by a teacher or student in a lesson, or copying a portion of a Sports Illustrated magazine article for use in a related court case. So anyway, that's clearly the position that Google took, was that we didn't copy all of Java. We copied a tiny portion, that is, these 37 APIs that Oracle is complaining about, out of, and we re-implemented them. We wrote them ourselves, but it was necessary for compatibility to duplicate this portion of the Java standard. And Oracle, you know, Sun never had a problem with it. Oracle didn't have a problem with it until way downstream, when it had been proven to have, when, you know, Google's use created a huge amount of value to their particular implementation. And so I guess, you know, in watching what the industry had, the way the industry has responded, there is a sense that this original judge, this is Judge Alsup, who we've talked about, he was also the judge who gave the jury instructions prior to their going away for 3 days of deliberation. And some people have said, it was a broad interpretation of fair use that this judge, who's been on, I wouldn't say he's been on Google's side, but we've talked about him. We talked about him in 2012 when this thing first when the case first happened. You know, he's the guy who taught himself Java in order to really come up to speed and understand this. His original ruling was that an API was not subject to copyright, and then Oracle got that overturned on appeal. And so then this 2 week long recent trial was Google's taking the position, okay, if API is subject to copyright, then our use is not an infringement of that copyright because it was fair under the fair use doctrine. And once again, Judge Alsop's court said, right, we agree. And so we can imagine that Oracle's going to say, well, we don't, and we're going to get this overturned on appeal again. So we're still, you know, once again, the decision is in Google's favor, and it does seem like Oracle is not going to give this up. Meanwhile, there was an interesting story that Bloomberg covered about Google's increasing pressure on their industry partners for keeping Android up to date. They had an interesting graphic in the story that I put into the show notes here, showing that whereas 84% of devices running iOS 9 are using the latest version, only 7.5% of devices running Android are running Marshmallow. So there's a dramatic difference in the support for the latest versions of the operating systems. What Google is trying to change the way the current smartphone ecosystem works, and we've talked about this extensively. The fact that whereas mainstream operating systems, notably Windows and and Mac have essentially moved updating into it being done by default on a schedule, interacting with the user, saying we're going to update at a certain time, or and updates are pushed out monthly and so forth. The problem is that the smartphone change has come to an industry that wasn't using smartphones. And of course, all of this echoes the sort of the IoT problem too, that we'll be talking about later in this podcast, and have been talking about in the last several podcasts. And that is that the smartphones are being sold by cellular carriers that have traditionally, sold feature phones or dumb phones or flip phones, or phones that didn't carry with them the burden of being kept updated. And so on the one hand, they want the revenue from selling a high value, expensive, high demand product, but they don't want the responsibility that inherently comes with selling a computer, an internet connected computer. And all of our experience tells us that internet connected computers that are inherently incredibly complex, using layers of software that other people wrote, pulling it all together, grabbing pieces from every direction, and cramming it into a ROM, and then saying, here you go, there's going to be bugs, vulnerabilities, problems. These things have to be updatable. And so the problem has been that there isn't that same drive to update. And so Google is like struggling to come up with a way to change the way this industry is behaving. So one of the things they're doing is using much more forceful tactics. Google has drawn up a list that now ranks the top phone makers by how up-to-date their handsets are, that is, out in the field, based on security patches and operating system versions. Google has shared this list with their Android partners earlier this year, and has discussed making it public to highlight those manufacturers who are proactive, and publicly shame vendors that are tardy in keeping their handsets up to date in order to put pressure on these companies. And, this is behavior. I mean, this is sort of a strategy that we've watched Google implement, in various other areas of the industry. That's what that's Google understands that people don't make change unless they're forced to. And so so there is tension that Google is creating with their downstream users of Android in order to put pressure on them to come up with approaches to keep their devices more up to speed. In the story that Bloomberg put out, there was, and I didn't put it here in the show notes because there's just too much to say, but they did mention that Verizon claimed it cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars to perform their own testing of all of this material that they were getting from Google that Google was pushing them to push out to their customers. And Verizon was feeling that they had a responsibility not to break their own customers' phones or there'd be hell to pay. And so this constant flow of patches isn't something they wanted. Verizon doesn't want that, because it's just, it creates a huge burden for them to deal with it. And so they've just been saying, no, you know, we're just, we want to leave things alone. And they're trying to shorten that process. Sprint has cut their time down from several months by a few weeks, trying to be responsive. But the problem is, you know, there isn't the mechanism in place. These companies are not used to being computer operating system vendors. And you know, Microsoft has years of experience doing this. Apple has years of experience doing it. The truth is, these are very sophisticated operating systems that are being treated like appliances. And of course, this tune is familiar to our listeners because this is the whole IoT problem. Now, one of the things that Google is doing is changing their behavior a little bit because they're seeing that they're unable to get the newest version of their operating systems out into the field. Like, only 7.5% of all Android devices are running Marshmallow today. So what they're doing is they're reducing their own reliance on this update process, which isn't functional. New features, such as, for example, the Allo messaging service, are not being packaged as part of a new OS. Rather, they're being packaged on purpose as standalone apps so that Google can offer these to non-current to users of Android that their vendors haven't patched, haven't updated, you know, that aren't current, so that they are able to provide them without the carrier being in the way. And for example, Instant Apps, which was unveiled at Google I/O recently, deliberately works on phones running versions as old as Jelly Bean, which came out in 2012. So what that means is 95% of the current Android user base will be able to get access to, for example, the Instant App technology, which Google's recognizing they're just not getting their partners to update. So they're deliberately making, you know, their newer things available not as part of a later generation OS, because then no one's ever going to have them. And this way, people are able to, you know, 95% of the current Android user base is from Jelly Bean or more recent. So anyway, I thought that was some interesting look at the problem that, you know, another aspect of, essentially, we can think of this as a flavor of IoT, you know, that where these things are smartphone appliances. You know, users just want them. They just want them to work, and they want them to be secure and to be kept up to date. But unfortunately, they're coming through an ecosystem where that hasn't been the case, and they don't want it to be the case. And so, as we've said on this podcast before, that has to change. You know, these are computers that people have in their pockets. I got a bunch of hubbub raised when the story was covered that Symantec had given Blue Coat Systems an intermediate certificate authority cert. Now, I immediately recognized Blue Coat because I had referred to them years ago when I did the certificate fingerprinting work at GRC. GRC certificate fingerprinting, talks about the idea of checking whether GRC sees the same certificate fingerprint as a user does, because a certificate fingerprint cannot be spoofed. And if there's a man in the middle, if there's any kind of of connection interception, which is a thing we're talking about all the time now on the podcast. For example, employers may deliberately, in order to deep scan HTTPS connections, they need to do that. Now, the sanctioned way of doing that is for the appliance on the perimeter to install its certificate on all of the machines within that employee or within that employer's network. Essentially, that it becomes a certificate authority. And so just as we do now, where we have CA certs in our machines telling us which CAs to trust, if you are working for a company that has one of these appliances, all of the machines within that intranet would have that CA cert added to them in order to allow that appliance to essentially create create certificates on the fly. Okay, well, what Symantec did was to give this Blue Coat Systems their own intermediate certificate, which, and that's bad. So what this means is, because everybody is trusting Symantec certs. Remember, they purchased VeriSign, the certificate business, the CA business from VeriSign. So all systems the world over have the VeriSign cert in their root store. So what a third party having an intermediate certificate from Symantec means is it's very different than this appliance operating on a controlled perimeter like a corporation. What this means is that this appliance does not need to put its certificate in all of the systems downstream from it, because since its cert is an intermediate certificate authority, it's able to create certificates which will automatically be trusted because Symantec has given it permission to do so. Now, when I went looking for some coverage of this, I thought, okay, I want a snarky take. So, of course, I went to the register.co.uk, which is where you go for snark. And they wrote, Blue Coat sells network equipment that does just this kind of espionage. I jumped down into their coverage. The gear intercepts connections to websites and strips the encryption away so secured communications can be monitored. This is useful for corporations that want to keep tabs on their staff at work. Unfortunately, Blue Coat's HTTPS snooping products have been used by repressive regimes to spy on activists online and quash dissent. To tear away the encryption and peek inside people's packets, Blue Coat's man-in-the-middle gear masquerades as legit websites. And this is so much easier to pull off when the manufacturer is an intermediate certificate authority, because it will have the flexibility to generate trusted certificates as required. It paves the way for seamless surveillance by Blue Coat built equipment. All absolutely true. The Register wrote, "We asked Blue Coat how it planned to use its new powers, and we were assured that its intermediate certificate was only used for internal testing and that the certificate is no longer in use." The two firms, meaning Symantec and Blue Coat, said in a statement, "Symantec has reviewed the intermediate CA issued to Blue Coat and determined it was used appropriately." Okay, whatever that means. And then they also said, consistent with their protocols, Symantec maintained, wrote Symantec, full control of the private key, and Blue Coat never had access to it. Okay, well, that's not how this works. So that can't be true. And then the statement continues, Blue Coat has confirmed it was used for internal testing and has since been discontinued. Therefore, rumors of misuse are unfounded. It's like, well, okay, except that the only way this works is for Blue Coat to have a private key, which is trusted by all the systems downstream of it by virtue of its certificate being signed by Symantec. That's what this was. So for anyone to say that Symantec maintained full control of the private key, well, they may have maintained full control of theirs, but the way an intermediate CA works is that it has a private key which it uses to sign the certificates it mints on the fly. So anyway, what's important to take away is for Blue Coat to do what it wants to. That is, for, you know, it is a provider of appliances that do this. But we should remember that what all they need in order to do this transparency is for any certificate authority out of the many hundreds, I think it's 1,100, that we implicitly trust, any one of those can do the same thing that Symantec was caught doing. And so the way they got caught was that someone looked at the certificate that Blue Coat was using, and apparently this was not being used for testing. This was somehow publicly found. But we should remember that any government that wants to do this just needs to have one of the certificate authorities under that government's control. I mean, China has them. You know, any government certainly has certificate authorities that they can say, they can instruct to produce a intermediate certificate and sign it, please. And then that intermediate certificate gets installed on the egress points to their network, or ingress points to their network or to their country, and they're able to decrypt all the traffic, and no red flags are raised by anyone's browser because that there's a chain of trust back from that intermediate certificate back to a trusted CA, a root certificate authority that is already in the trust store of everyone's computers. So this is the mixed blessing of our whole public key infrastructure, is it relies on trust. And unfortunately, over time, it's gotten very top heavy or very, very trust heavy. Okay, so there was an interesting study conducted by Duo Labs, and my title for this was Bloatware Insecurity Continues to Haunt Consumer and Business Laptops. And Leo, I've heard you talking about, you know, the whole bloatware problem, the problem of just all laptops containing some add-on software.
All Windows laptops.
Right.
That's not all laptops, thank goodness.
Okay, yes. Thank you. I'm glad you clarified.
Yeah. Really, it's Windows is the, yeah, right.
Right. Well, and in fact, I haven't mentioned that, you know, when it became clear that Microsoft was saying that they were going to abandon support for older hardware, I did update myself to a state-of-the-art, it's a fourth-gen Carbon X1 Lenovo. And the first thing I did was strip it and attempt to reinstall Windows 7. Windows 7 would not install on that laptop.
Really?
Because it already had Skylake and Lenovo wasn't providing those drivers separately. So, and I think I heard you mention that your HP, that you were having problems installing Linux.
Yeah, I have weird errors. HP. Maybe that's it, yeah.
That's the reason, yeah. Is that now what will happen is in time, Linux will catch up with drivers for that hardware.
Right.
But the hardware is newer than our operating systems. And anyway, so what I was forced to do was to roll back to the original Windows 7 that came on this Carbon X1 fourth gen laptop. And then I went in and surgically removed all of the nonsense, all of that Lenovo crap that is added to it, which is all of their own, you know, we're going to, you know, keep all of this stuff updated. And that's the point of this story, is that this Duo Labs took a look at Acer, Asus, Dell, two different Dell laptops, and HP, and two different Lenovos, and looked at the security of it. And I have another graphic here in the show notes. Many of them transmit. Many of them do not transmit the manifest. That is, they have an XML manifest, which their update managers use in order to query what's changed. A couple of them do use TLS, but many of them don't. So that's going back and forth in the clear with no security over it. The researchers published a report on 10 new laptops, all running either Windows 8.1 or Windows 10, including some Microsoft Signature Edition machines that are supposed to be bloatware-free, but still include some of these components. All of the updaters specify their own update manifests where the system grabs a remote XML file over HTTP. Only the Dell systems update over HTTPS. So, of course, that's a concern because anyone who is able to intercept that XML file could change it on the fly. None of the manifests are signed, and they don't use proper engineering practices to make sure the integrity of the manifest is validated properly. All of the manifests include commands to ensure that the updates run properly, meaning that a bad guy could simply hijack those commands and use that to execute whatever they wish with system-level permissions. And all of these updaters run with system-level permissions, meaning that they're able to bypass any other security protections on the machine. So what we're seeing is, again, and this is like this sort of becoming a theme as we look closely at what happens when third parties are involved in what need to be secure solutions, is that they're just their focus is on making this stuff work, not making it secure. So what Duo Labs found was that every vendor shipped with a pre-installed updater that had at least one vulnerability, resulting in arbitrary remote code execution as system, allowing for a complete compromise of the affected machine. Vendors often failed to make even basic use of TLS, properly validating update integrity, or verify the authenticity of the update manifest contents, meaning that, you know, they weren't bothering to sign them and validate signatures, so they could be changed at will and the updating software wouldn't know any different. Vendors sometimes had multiple software updaters for different purposes and different implementations, some more secure than others. So in one case, there was one that was secure, but there was, you know, it was running alongside one that wasn't. And what this does is create a large attack surface, which is being created by this ancillary OEM software components, which the updaters are introducing to the system. So unfortunately, we have all of this focus on the OS security, where, you know, Windows is doing everything it can to keep itself hardened and secure, yet this unwanted bloatware, which all of these vendors are adding, is making the systems insecure. So essentially what this says is, when you get one of these machines, you want to, and this is what I've heard you talking about on Windows Weekly with Paul and Mary Jo, is just immediately, if you can, reinstall Windows. If you can't, then go in and just get rid of this stuff, which you didn't ask for, and which is doing nothing but creating an exposed attack surface. It looks like, without exception, this stuff is a serious security problem.
Although I noticed the Lenovo Solution Center gets all green checks. Is the update agent running, though, on all Lenovos? Because if it is, then it doesn't matter, because it gets all red X's.
Correct. And that's a perfect example. What, you know, one thing is all green,
right,
but the update engine is running alongside, and it's all bad.
Oh, Lord. So, but if I wiped it and put vanilla Windows 10 on this HP, Windows is doing it right, is what you're saying. It's just,
correct,
Microsoft's doing it right. It's just these third-party solutions.
Correct.
Including updaters. Yeah, and everybody puts updaters on. Everybody does.
I know. And so what this was a study of was, you know, 10 of these systems, are any of them secure? And the answer is no, not a single one. It was done correctly.
Wow.
Because, again, security is hard, and their goals are just to make it work.
Yeah.
They're under the gun. Their programmers are being told, you know, we were supposed to have this last month. You know, finish it today.
Well, I guess I'll be wiping my HP and putting Windows 10 on it until I can... Because Windows 10 will work with the Skylake. It's just Windows 7 that wouldn't.
Correct.
Yeah. And you correct, could probably slipstream something in there that might make it work.
In this case, it was, you know, I only purchased it like 2 months ago. It was when Microsoft said, okay, we're going to stop supporting this. Because all of my laptops are much older.
And that won't happen, by the way, for a couple of years. So that's not the issue. It's just, maybe there's some pieces you need in your Windows 7 or something.
Correct. It was doubtless the mass storage drive, the mass storage,
yes,
hardware,
right,
isn't, you know, because, you know, the original Windows 7, even Service Pack 1, it's way years ago.
Right.
And so if you can't get that to go, then you're unable to bring it current. So, and Lenovo is not officially supporting Windows 7 on the modern hardware. You know, it's like, and I had to go in and say, no, I don't want Windows 10. I want Windows 7. So I had that downgrade permission, but they're still not officially supporting it with like, you know, exposed, you know, driver packages and everything.
Yeah. Well, maybe it'd be worth trying to get Linux on here instead of Windows 10, but I'll figure it out.
So I just did a refresh of the Never 10 page. I just wanted to give everybody an update. 783,503 downloads.
That's awesome.
783,000. It has wildly broken every record in GRC's long history of very popular freeware. We're seeing more than 35,000 downloads per day.
I can't believe somebody from Microsoft hasn't come to your house.
A day.
Said, Mr. Gibson, it has come to our attention.
Oh.
You have blocked nearly a million people from installing.
Well, it'll this time next week for next week's podcast, we will be north of a million downloads of Never 10.
Shh. Steve who? Don't know him. Never heard of him. Mm-mm.
Yeah. No, and that's just GRC. All the other download sites now offer it too. And so they're, you know, they're downloading it like crazy too. So
get it from the original source. Let Steve bear the brunt of this. Don't get it from someone that's going
to
put.
Well, it's nice to have a count. Well, yeah. And frankly, you know, there was one guy who accused Never 10 of completely screwing up his system. And boy, he was mad. Oh, Lord. I mean, you know, he was dropping the F-bomb all over the place and screaming at us. And so I answered his email. I wrote back to him and I said, sir, I'm sorry that somehow your machine has been messed up. But really, it couldn't have been by Never 10. Never 10 sets two registry entries.
It doesn't do anything.
That Microsoft documents and sanction.
Yeah.
And by the way, at that point, we were north of half a million. And I said, half
first.
A million people have used this. And no one, it hasn't hurt anybody else's machine.
Right.
And I also said, you know, and he wrote like he didn't know who we were. And I said, if you got this from somewhere else, one of the dangers of getting it from somewhere else is that bad guys will use super popular software as a means of getting malware into your machine.
Guy smiling in our chat room saying the Major Geeks download site is wrapping it with other stuff. So you really
perfect.
Don't. Yeah, perfect example. And they have 16,769 downloads there. So those people are get it from the original source. Always, always, always. Don't get it from these download sites that just really are kind of piggybacking on success.
Right, and try to get you to download their manager. You know,
shameful.
You know, exactly, and you know, and then take over your browser and get the ask toolbar and other junk. Yeah. Okay. So,
by the way, just get Linux, Steve. Would you please do me a favor? Stop trying to make any of this stuff work and just put Linux on everything. I wish you would.
Yeah, I installed Linux.
Good. See, easy, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I had to do it because there were some problems with Squirrel under Wine.
So you had to try it, yeah.
And so, it wasn't fair for me to keep asking.
Written an implementation for Linux? I'm surprised.
Not natively. No, I mean, it's got to get out there first.
Yeah.
So let's take a break so I can catch my breath.
Catch your breath. Have a drink of coffee.
Yes.
Because you need to keep your head clear for the Internet of Things in its infancy. And it is, in the words of Shakespeare, a mewling and puking babe. But we were talking about earlier about the TV show Silicon Valley, which, of course, we're big fans of. Maybe you noticed in the Pied Piper headquarters, the folks, that nice, shiny new one, they kind of got kicked out of there, but they kept the chair. They should have kept the Veridesks. They had all Veridesks in their entire facility. And we love them. We're going to have all Veridesks in our newest studio, which is, you know, kind of taking some of the sting out of moving for our staff. Hey, at least they get these great new desks. Veridesk converts your existing desk easily, simply, with no installation problems, into a sitting or standing desk. And when I say sitting or standing, I mean sitting or standing depending on your mood today or this moment, because Veridesks can go back and forth. You can work sitting or work standing. Now, we know that sitting down all day is not good for your blood pressure, for your blood sugar, for your weight. The Mayo Clinic has research that says it puts you at a greater risk for a range of health problems. So standing up, even if it's just a little bit during the day, really, I feel good about it. So Veridesk, these are easy. They sit on top of, you can get a standalone Veridesk, but most people get the desks that sit on top of your existing desk. So you go in your cubicle, you don't need boss approval. You just order the Veridesk. It starts as little as $175 with free shipping in the continental United States. It comes fully assembled. You just pull it out of the box, put it on your desk. You can put your monitors, your gear on it, all your stuff, because these are spring-loaded with a different, you know, up to 11 different height settings. So it's really simple for you to raise and lower it, even with weight on it. Varidesk, V-A-R-I-D-E-S-K.com. We have this one, the Pro Plus 36, here at the Brick House. And that was kind of, I wanted people to try it. I said, what do you think? Do you want something like this at the new office? And they all said, oh, yeah. Why wouldn't you? You can still sit down if you want, or stand up if you're in the mood. The Pied Piper offices had the ProDesk 60 all throughout it. That's just awesome. I want you to check it out. Lifehacker called Varidesk one of their five best standing desks. It also has been featured on Product Hunt and Gear Patrol. Really nice, easy to use, affordable, easy to install. It's not an IKEA puzzle. You don't have to put it together. It comes done. Visit varidesk.com and check out their wide range of height adjustable desks for your desk or your cubicle. And make sure you say, hey, thanks for doing the Twit Studios, Varidesk. Thank you. They do have the standalone too, I think, yeah. Varidesk. Thank them for their support of Security Now. All right, you feel calm, you feel collected, your blood pressure's gone down. No, seriously, a lot of this stuff we talk about, it's like just the steam starts coming out of my ears. It's like, how could they do this? It was because of this whole Windows 10 thing that I finally said, you know what, I'm going to put Linux on one of these machines. I've used it for years, but could I use it day in, day out? And now I don't want to use anything else, to be honest with you. Debian is my preferred distro. And you probably heard I ordered a kind of high-end Linux laptop as my studio system.
You're panting over it.
Very excited. It's a 17-inch laptop. I mean, where I'm at the roundtable for Twit and MacBreak Weekly and Twig, I can't use a desktop. I use a desktop in here in my office, but I can't use a desktop. But I want a laptop that's, it's always plugged in. It doesn't need to be portable. So this thing, I'm sure it weighs 8 pounds, but it's an i7 and 32 gigs of RAM, and it's got an NVIDIA N980M GPU, and tomorrow I get it. I'll let you know. But there's something nice about running an open source operating system with no spyware. One of the reasons I don't run Ubuntu, and this laptop from System76 does come with Ubuntu, so I'm going to have to weigh this, is for a while Ubuntu was routing your search. Look at that. Nice. Nice. You're using Ubuntu. So
yep.
Yeah. I think they're all right now. I don't like it that you see there's an Amazon icon there in the dock. That kind of bugged me. And for a while, they actually were sending search queries to Amazon. So I kind of got soured on Ubuntu. And then there was the Ubuntu One fiasco. And I think they've cleaned up their act. I think they realize people don't like that kind of stuff. Not an open source operating system. But I decided to go back to the distro that Ubuntu is based on, which is Debian, which, by the way, nowadays is just as easy and straightforward to install on existing hardware as Ubuntu is.
And in fact, that was one of the, that's an older T500 ThinkPad
Lenovo's
that I had.
Great for Linux.
That I had lying around, and it just, it just went right in. And it was flawless. It recognized all the hardware. Networking came up, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth. I can close the lid and it puts itself in standby, so all power management is working perfectly. No, it was a great experience.
Yeah, it really is amazing. Yeah. I mean, we've come so far since the first time I tried to install Linux, which was a Slackware distro in 94 or 95. And it was a nightmare, not to mention that it was on multiple CDs or maybe even floppies. It was a little bit
different. I had to do a few things. There's some controversy about on the Ubuntu desktop because the tray was becoming overloaded with icons.
I don't like it. Yeah.
And so
obviously. Everything can be changed.
Yes. And in fact, so for example, Squirrel uses the tray to show its little icon in the tray, and you're able to access settings and do things and change things. So I had to go in and fix that. I had to immediately swap caps lock and control, as we talked about earlier, in order for that to be workable.
Easily done, though. There's a tweak tool.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. So I was Squirrel.
Yes.
A bunch of people have asked where we are. With caveats, it's done. So let me give everybody sort of a sense.
Those are two words I didn't expect to hear out of your mouth. Wow, that's great.
Well, and yeah. So one of the things that Squirrel has that, for example, that Fido, the, you know, arguably some competition for it, maybe someday in the future, is the whole Squirrel system provides complete identity management, whereas Fido says that's somebody else's problem. It's like it's out of spec. You know, the individual implementers will deal with managing identities. For me, that was as much a part of making this thing user friendly as anything else. And you know, and the reason Never 10 is like going like just burning up the wires is that it's just so simple. I mean, you know, the somebody was it How To Geek? Somebody actually referred to me as an unknown developer. I thought, well, okay, you know, they may not know me, but you know, they were recommending Never 10 because it's just tiny and it just does the job and it works. So one of the things that Squirrel does is in this identity management is that there is a we had to deal with the possibility that someone's private key might get out of their control. The whole concept with Squirrel, as our users know, our listeners know, and we'll of course give it again coverage once this thing is downloadable for everyone to play with, is that you create one master key, and then all of the websites you visit receive a derivative of that based on their domain name. And the derivative is the way they identify you every time you come back. And by signing a challenge that they provide, you prove that you are the owner of the key that they know you by, essentially. So in a perfect world, there is no, there's you're giving the website essentially a public key. But the way to think of it is you're giving them no secret to keep. And that's one of the keys. In all traditional login, you're giving them a secret. You're giving them your username and password, and you're needing them not to lose it, not to let it out of their control. Well, we know how well that works. You know, we were talking about 117 million passwords that were published a week ago from an old LinkedIn breach just last week. But the point is that the coolest part of Squirrel is that what you give the website is a public key, which is unique for that website, derived from your super secret master key that never leaves your control. And so the website knows you and identifies you by that public key. And so the simplicity of Squirrel is that the website sends you a nonce, a random blob. We call it a nut, of course, instead of a nonce, because it's Squirrel. The website sends you a nut. You sign that with the private key, which corresponds to that website's domain, which again is derived on the fly from your super secret master key. So there's only one thing, one secret that Squirrel has. The entire system then works off of that. And so every different website gets a different public key. And that's the point, is that it's a public key. they could lose it. They could publish it if they wanted to. Doesn't hurt anybody because it's not of any use to anybody else, because in order to use it, you have to be able to, you have to have the matching private key that only the actual originator of that public key would have. So it's, from that standpoint, it's very simple. But the question then is, what happens if that one super secret private key is compromised? And we just can't say, oh, well, that's not our responsibility. That's, you know, that's out of spec or something. No, we had to deal with it. So in the squirrel system, if you believed that something happened, if you were worried, you had some concrete reason to believe that the private key was compromised, that your identity's one super secret master key was compromised, then we need a means of replacing it that is not burdensome. So Squirrel incorporates the concept of a previous key, and your Squirrel identity, that is this it's just a file, which is has a well-defined structure as part of the spec, it can carry both your current and your previous super secret. So essentially, you rekey, you are a user. If they, like, if the government got your phone, or you know, something led you to believe you could no longer trust in the integrity of your squirrel identity, whatever the reason, you are free at any time to rekey your identity. What that then means is you carry both. And when you go to a website and perform this squirrel authentication, again, all of this is hidden from the user. All they see is the QR code, and they snap it with their smartphone or they click it with the mouse. What happens is the site tells you whether it recognizes you by your current key, or if you have one, your previous key. And if the site recognizes you by your previous key, it behind the scenes automatically updates to your current key. So it forms in crypto terms a sort of a ratchet, where it's able to take the secret, the obsoleting secret, the secret that is in the process of being obsoleted, and use that to jump to the current one. And so the idea would be that essentially that makes this whole process transparent for all Squirrel users. They rekey their identity for any reason, and then they, as they log on to websites that still know them, that they haven't logged into since, that thus still know them by their old key, it's transparently updated to the new key. So that's the way the system had been from its beginning. The argument was, okay, well, what if, like, something was really wrong and you needed to rekey again? That is, have a second rekeying, and Squirrel only kept the previous key, and you hadn't visited all the websites that know you by your first obsoleted key before you had obsoleted the key again. And so it was like, well, okay, how far do we take this? And so the point is, what I spent, maybe it was, I'm not sure how long ago it was and how long it was, but basically we came to a compromise. And that was that first of all, remember that maybe many users in their entire use of Squirrel will never rekey even once. That is, it'll just work. But again, we have to, this has to survive worst casing. So it's like, okay, we really want this to work, but the potential to become an industry standard. So there can't be any gotchas. So we settled on four, just because We don't want the identities to become too big. They become burdensome. And remember that it's the only time you would need more is if you were like re-keying like crazy, such that any site you visited didn't know you by, for example, any of your four previous identity or four previous keyings, which seems unlikely given that no one may, in fact, ever need to rekey even once. But a good use case where you would probably want to rekey is, for example, Stina at Yubico has expressed a strong interest in immediately supporting Squirrel the moment we officially say it's done. And so if you were using it without hardware support, then I would rekey my identity for hardware. That is, because what Yubico would produce would be an HSM, a hardware security module, where the signing process never left the hardware. So it was virtually then impossible for it ever to get out of your control or be lost, in which case I could see that rekeying makes sense. Anyway, so one of the things that had to happen was that the storage spec had to be updated. The interactive spec needed to be changed, and this change has had some repercussions through the spec. So that's all done, and the Squirrel client and the demo website. In fact, I think Jeff's iOS client is already up to speed. Actually, he beat me there. He had the four previous identities support before I did. So we're current there. And then as I was going through the client, one of the things that I wanted to fix was the textual input. And I'm only bringing this up because it was like it's the most recent thing I just finished. And I had them, here. So this is... this page, the Squirrel client prints for you. One of the key concepts of Squirrel is that there is no one to there is no one to ask when you forget your password. That's one of the keys here. Is any third party system there is password recovery. If you can say to the website, "Oh, I forgot my password. Send me an email link." Well, that's a mixed blessing, of course, because that means that there is a password, a secret that they're keeping, and that there is a process for recovering the password that is subject to exploitation. With Squirrel, there is no third party. There's no one to go to if you forget your password. So as part of creating a complete solution, we had to make it practical for there to be no recourse. And so one of the things that Squirrel does is it goes out of its way to help you come up with solutions for "I forgot my password." One of them is your identity as a QR code, so this is a piece of paper you put away. When you create your identity, you print it out and you put it away. Maybe you put it in a safety deposit box or in a shoe box or wherever your other private papers and things are kept, so that this is your get out of jail free card. You can. If you only had your Squirrel identity loaded in one smartphone and the dog ate it, or it you lost it or something horrible happened to it, this is your Squirrel identity. Well, one form of that is printed out ASCII, and it is I forgot how many characters. Well, and actually it varies because here is an identity that has never been rekeyed, and here is one that has been rekeyed. So it's carrying its previous and current key with it, and you can see it's getting longer. Well, there's white space at the end of this page because you might have a third or a fourth key, which, again, makes it increasingly long. So typically that would, as I said, someone might never rekey. They just may not need to, but we wanted to make it feasible. So how do we enter something like this that's long and potentially over the user's use, over their whole lifetime of use, getting longer? What I just finished working on last week was in Windows, we call it a custom control. It is, you know, a control is something like a button or a drop-down list box or a text field or whatever. Well, I had to create one from scratch because I wanted exactly correct behavior. I wanted the user to, you know, when we print that out, it's in multiple lines with five groups of four characters. So I wanted the grouping to be enforced so that as the user entered it, it automatically grouped itself. Windows doesn't have that capability automatically. People who've entered those like Windows license keys, you know, they're what Windows has done is have individual text fields, but it's uncomfortable. That sort of you tab between them. You're unable to cursor between them. It just doesn't work very well. Mine works beautifully, but the other thing I wanted was as you go confirmation of everything you've done so far is correct. So as you're entering the text into the line, when you enter the 20th character, as you're entering it, the line is red. When you enter the 20th character, it turns green only if everything you've done so far is perfect. So the first 19 characters you enter are actually the key, part of the keying information. The 20th character is a check character based on a modulus 55 of the hash of all the preceding characters. And I should mention that the identity is base 56, not 55. It is 56 printable characters with the confusing ones removed. So there's no ones, there's no zeros, because ones look too much like lowercase l, and zero looks too much like uppercase O, of which there aren't any. And so what I did was I took all of the alphabet and removed anything confusing, resulting in if we had the whole alphabet and numbers, what would we have? We'd have 26 in upper and lower case, so 52 plus another 10, so that would be 62. And so instead we have 56. I've eliminated a bunch of the confusing ones. And so identities are in this base 56 alphabet, and there's a base 56 check character. So as you go, these lines turn green, and because there are some people that have red-green color blindness, I didn't want to make it. I didn't want to depend upon that. So you are unable to proceed on the next line if any previous line is incorrect. So if it won't let you go further and you can't see that it has not turned green, then your cue is, well, I must have a mistake in the previous line, and you're able then to go look at it again, just inspect it, move the cursor up, fix the character. It'll then allow you to proceed. So anyway, all of that's done. I also then just added, just as a nice little touch, the squirrel icon prints itself down at the bottom of the page printout. But we got reports from, or I got reports in I say we because of the it's all being done in the Squirrel News Group on GRC that that was crashing under Wine when the Squirrel client was run on Linux. And so what I just spent the weekend doing was installing Ubuntu 16.04, the LTS, on a laptop. And I found that that was due to an unimplemented function, which I was using. So I coded around that. And at the
That's
moment...
Nice. A function unimplemented in Wine, like you were calling something that Wine didn't support.
Correct.
Yeah.
Cool. And in fact, I run across that a lot. For example, the other problem is that I'm wanting to use Courier New under Windows because Courier is a monospaced font, and the serifs are make the like K uppercase K and lowercase K very different looking. You know, if I removed all possible confusion between characters, we'd end up with six. And so that would make the identity too long because we wouldn't have enough bits per character. So I had to make a trade-off. The problem is one of the other things broken in Wine is something that is called the font mapper in Windows, where you're able to specify sort of a generic the generic characteristics you want for a font, and then Windows says, oh, you want, you know, I have one that matches what you've asked for here. And in fact, it always gives me Courier. And under Wine, it never gives me a monospace font. It just doesn't – that's completely broken in Wine. So I'm in the process with the news group of identifying – universally available fonts, or what it looks like I may do is take the free mono font, which is one of the free open type fonts, and remove all the glyphs from it that I'm not using. I tried that late last night, and that allowed me, after compression, to only increase the XE size by 15K. So that would be me bringing my own subset of Courier New, which is now which is in the free version, is free mono, bringing that in and carrying it in the client. So I'm absolutely guaranteed of what the user is going to see. And I'm a little worried about foreign language fonts and font, you know, in other countries, because I want to make this universal. So that's a sense for, you know, this process. I haven't been talking about it because, I mean, while I've been working on it, it's slow going. You know, I want to get it done. It's got my full time and attention. I mean, but again, I'm wanting it to be perfect, and we're very close. When I said with some caveats, it's done. So, there's still some Wine problems. Wine's fonts seem to be longer horizontally than the Windows API knows. You're able to ask Windows, how long is this font? That is, here's a string in this font. What number of pixels long is it? And I use that in order to trim the size of the controls. Well, Wine trims them wrong. And so the ends of the strings are being chopped off. So I want to give Wine some attention. Bottom line is, it's done. There is some language I need to change in the UI because I was originally talking about creating a new identity rather than rekeying an existing identity. So the UI doesn't yet have the notion of rekeying, just, you know, in the language. So I need to do that, but. You know, it's been working for quite a while. We kill it when some major upheaval occurs, like going from one previous identity to four previous identities. That took it down for a while and had repercussions throughout the code, which I then had to fix. But it's been up again. And I think we're done. So there are a number of things, like, for example, when you when you click on the when you're running the client and you click on the QR code in order to log in, at the moment, the first time you do it, that launches Squirrel. It gets focus, and you can just type right into the, you know, type your, you know, enter your password just to prove that it's you in front of the computer. Because, you know, Squirrel does still need somehow to authenticate you to it, and then it handles all of the per website authentication for you. But it's still necessary for, you know, to prove you're you and not somebody who just walked up to your computer. The problem is when it's Squirrel is already running and you do this, it launches a new instance which looks to see that it's already running and hands off control to that to the existing instance. The problem is that Windows has it deliberately prevents other Windows from obtaining focus because that can be abused for like annoying pop-ups and things where something jumps, you know, pops up and takes focus away from what you were doing. So at the moment, that's something I need to fix. But we're at that level. We're to the point now where for the next, I don't know how long, I'm tempted to say a couple weeks, I will be in cleaning up all of those things. I have a long list of things that I've made notes of, many of which have already been fixed, but I haven't gone back and removed them from my to-do list. So we're very close. You know, it's done. So I hope soon to be able to say, here is, you know, I mean, it'll appear on the website. People can download it, create Squirrel identities, play with the demo site that we've had. I mean, this is the thing that, you know, long time ago, Leo, you brought it up on your laptop and, you know, showed it on the screen. And I used Jeff's iOS client to log myself into your laptop over Skype.
Oh, man, I remember that.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, the technology, you know, that fundamental technology has been running for a long time. But I want this thing to be polished because we know I have a tendency once I finish things to be only dragged back to them kicking and screaming, which brings me to Spinrite 6.1, which of course I can't wait to get back to because it needs my attention next.
Good.
So that's where we are with Squirrel. It's you know, as far as I know, it's finished. Like in every meaningful way, it could be used today. I need to finish up aspects of the UI, things that like there's one dialogue where I keep coming to it and it finishes its work and it waits for me to hit next rather than automatically jumping to like the next screen. And it says, okay, well, it ought to do that. So it's that level. It's just the debris that needs to get cleaned up. So
would have been easier to write it from scratch, I think, at this point, but okay.
That's okay. That's okay.
Yep.
Awesome.
Okay. So I wanted to share three tweets with people. One was from Pat, who tweeted me from the Tweet Guy 99. He said, Steve, I recently listened to your discussion of Chrome versus Firefox in SN episode 557. And I was struck by your comment that, quote, most users would be better served by Chrome. I'm a sysadmin for a small company, about 50 employees, and I check all of our end user machine logs each week. Boy, this guy's a responsible sysadmin. In reviewing those logs, two things stand out each and every week. First, Internet Explorer is by far the application that crashes the most. And two, virtually all of the malware events we experience are drive-by infections by legitimate websites hosting malicious ads. So I thought, it's time to deploy Chrome to everyone. Dave, meaning Google, they've made it fairly easy for enterprises to deploy. MSI installers group policy templates, etc. And so I've begun rolling out test installations of Chrome with our favorite ad blocker preloaded, uBlock Origin. We're already seeing positive results. Even had one user go back to a website that tried to download malicious code onto his machine via Internet Explorer just 30 minutes prior, and was pleased to see that no installation was even attempted when using Chrome with uBlock Origin. So anyway, I just wanted to share that, a bit of feedback from the field, somebody saying IE was crashing more than anything else, and all malware events that he was logging were from websites hosting malicious ads, and by switching to Chrome with uBlock Origin, problem solved. Rob Woodruff, you had a comment, Leo?
No, go ahead.
Oh. Hi.
When you're done, I'm still working on getting Linux installed on this HP.
Perfect.
And here's an interesting thing I just noted.
Yeah.
Of course, the HP has TPM on it, the Trusted mm-hmm. Platform module. And I know enough to turn on legacy boot and turn off secure boot because that always keeps you from installing a operating system other than Windows. But it turns out you also have to reset the TPM if you want to install somebody.
Clean something. It out.
Yeah. Yeah. The TPM must have some information about Windows in it, like don't install any of that other stuff.
Right.
So
interesting.
Yeah, I'm cool. Playing with it still. Haven't quite gotten there, but we're getting there bit cool. by bit. Yep.
So Rob Woodruff tweeted, he said, "Hey, Steve, I listened to the podcast from Tuesday, and Carl in Indiana with a Netgear cable modem probably needs to get a firmware update." Remember, this is where I was talking about, he was saying that this is on the whole issue of constantly needing to reboot his cable modem. And I said, if restarting the cable modem brings you back online, then it's got to be a problem with the cable modem. So anyway, Rob said he listened to that podcast. He says, and he probably needs to get a firmware update. He said, "I've seen a lot of Netgear cable modems with Comcast have that exact same problem, whereas the SMC cable modems that Comcast provided prior to the Netgear cable modems work just fine. Comcast worked with Netgear to develop a firmware update that was supposed to alleviate that symptom." He says, "I'm not sure who Carl's cable modem provider in Indiana is, but he might want to check with them to see about a firmware update. Either that or ask for a different brand of cable modem." But I did hear not only from Rob but others that changing cable modem solved their problems for them. And finally, I really like this. I can't pronounce this person's name. Stijn. Stijn. Krevits. Krevits. Said something that I thought was so sharp. He said, "Steve, don't you think not allowing the filtering of Win updates through APIs is more secure? For one, malware would otherwise be able to block security updates." And that's like one of those head slappers. It's like, of course. Remember, and this, of course, is relative to Never 10, because I have commented that Microsoft doesn't provide a clean means for preventing Windows updates. And I was complaining about it because wouldn't it be nice if Never 10 could simply uninstall 303.5583 and then prevent its reinstallation? But it's like, that's not good because, exactly as he mentions, if there was an API that allowed you to say, okay, don't install these updates, well, that's what malware would do in order to keep itself from being washed away by updates. So thank you for that little bit of reality. I appreciated that. I just, it, obviously, once you hear it, it's like, yeah, that's one thing that you don't want software running in the machine to have control over is the machine's own updates. On the other hand, it does mean that we are pretty much a victim of whatever Microsoft wants to push on us through the Windows update mechanism, over which we have no good control. And finally, a note from a Spinrite user whose name, it's Sitbit, Sitbit in London, Ontario, Canada. The subject was YAST, Y-A-S-T exclamation point. And I'm not familiar, but maybe that's a SUSE package manager, because he said in parens, not a SUSE package manager, but rather that's his acronym for yet another Spinrite testimonial. And he said, hello, Steve and Leo. Love you guys. The show's fantastic, yada, yada, etc. Just a short and sweet Spinrite story. I had an old 320 gigabyte spinning disk salvaged from a laptop that I used to store some of my data. It wasn't terribly important, but I didn't want to lose it. So I had it mirrored to a backup drive. Well, the drive failed. So the directory I had it hanging off of showed up as empty. So my mirroring software dutifully deleted my backup, thinking the files had been purposely removed. Long story short, I caused Steve to hear a yabba-dabba-doo, which of course is the sound that my system makes when someone purchases a copy of Spinrite. I always am appreciative because that, as I have said, pays the bills around here. And he says, and 2 hours later, my drive was back in action. Thank you for this wonderful product. Thanks again, Sitbit. And thank you for the great testimonial. I'm glad for a yabba-dabba-doo, and we could recover the data lost from your drive and bring it back online. Meanwhile, Leo, how's your Linux install going?
Something weird's happening. I'll tell you what's happening.
I think the hardware is too
might
new.
Be. So yeah. I use to install Linux, as most do nowadays, a USB key, and I'm using one. I have a Debian here, a Ubuntu, and a Fedora, and I've used the Debian and Ubuntu keys many times to install. So I know they're good.
On older laptops.
And the install starts up. The installer starts up everything. But then at some point it says, okay, where's your CD-ROM drive? Which I've never seen before.
That's it. Because what's happened is it's trying to switch from the BIOS that it was using. It was using the BIOS for accessing the drives.
Right.
It tried to switch to its own driver. And when it switched to its own driver,
that's what happened.
It could no longer see the install media.
Yeah. Wow.
You might try switching. Oh, you don't have a built-in CD.
No, I'm trying. The Fedora is a net install. So what I'm hoping is that it maybe will continue the install over the Ethernet.
Correct.
Who knows what'll happen?
Worth trying. it's a PXE install.
We'll see. I would think. I don't know. Because you know what? They don't want you to put anything but Windows on this. That's really
no,
the truth.
And that's my... You put it on the CD. I burned a DVD. It occupied about half of it. Or it's like 1.7 gig, I think, on a DVD. And again, it's older hardware. And so it knew how to talk to the device, the actual physical hardware...
I haven't purchased a machine with a CD-ROM drive in years, literally like 3 or 4 years. But I guess I can, I have a USB drive around somewhere. Probably won't work either. Anyway.
No, I thought if your USB dongle didn't work, I think USB
that
CD
work would, either, would it?
But it's worth trying a net install, an over-the-net install.
Hoping that'll work. All right. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I wanted a little bit of a breather.
This is the issue, though, and it's one of the reasons I ended up buying a Linux first laptop is because these manufacturers, they're working so closely with Microsoft, And they see it as a security issue. Oh, you know, we want to make sure you're installing a legitimate Windows 10 on here and nothing else.
I know.
But that's you know, it's a limitation of the hardware.
It's a foreclosure, right, frankly, of, you right, know, of the industry, unfortunately.
Yeah, Dell is good. Dell continue, and Lenovo, I think, continue to support other operating systems.
Well, and I just think, again, I think it's that laptop is brand new.
Right.
And similarly,
somebody will solve this, in other words, in the Linux community.
Yes, yeah. It'll be, yeah, you know, I'm sure somebody's already, you know, one of the kernel gurus is working on updating the driver to incorporate support for whatever right, that latest chipset is that is in the HP. Because I had exactly the same problem when I tried to do a clean install of this brand new fourth generation Carbon. As it said, you know, it lost the access to the mass storage when it tried to switch over to it.
I may be forced to use Windows 10, and isn't that what Microsoft wants?
Yeah.
After all.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so IoT in its infancy. I actually came up with an acronym, IDIoT, which is, you know, I don't Internet of Things. and of course, that's idiot.
IDIoT, yes.
Uh-huh. So one little anecdote I loved was something that I picked up, and I've been saving it for when we could talk about this. And we've often talked about the CVE, that's the common vulnerabilities and exposures. What CVE is an industry-wide list of information like system security vulnerabilities and exposures, whose goal is to provide common names for publicly known cybersecurity issues. The goal of CVE is to make it easier to share data across separate vulnerability capabilities, tools, repositories, and services. That is, you know, to give us a common numbering for like all vulnerabilities in the industry. So what I got a kick out of was, and that's at cve.mitre.org. MITRE.org. They posted an update, and this is maybe a month or two ago, but I grabbed it because I just like one of these. Oh my God. It says, update: the recent explosion of internet enabled devices known as the Internet of Things, as well as the propagation of software based functionality in systems, has led to a huge increase in the number of CVE requests we have been receiving on a daily basis. We did not anticipate this rate of growth, and as a result, we're not as prepared for the latest surge in requests over the past 12 months as we had hoped. The result has been some of the delay in CVE assignments that the software security community has recently witnessed. We recognize the inconvenience that has resulted and are working hard to come up with a solution. Last week, we proposed a possible option to our CVE editorial board, but some members raised concerns about the approach, and we have withdrawn it from consideration. We're working diligently to come up with a solution that will meet the needs of all the various use cases of CVE. In other words, the Internet of Things has overloaded the long-running existed CVE management system. They cannot provide indexes and numbers and names for vulnerabilities fast enough, as the Internet of Things is creating problems for the industry. So one of the little studies that I ran across when I was putting this together, and this is something else that I've been holding on to for a while, but only for a few weeks, was Network World reported on a Bitdefender study. We've talked about Bitdefender. They're a well-known security company, they examined four popular Internet of Things devices. One was, of course, the Wemo products. Wemo is popular enough that probably everybody has heard of them, used to control lights and wall sockets. They found that the switch communicates with the smartphone without authentication. The only thing encrypted is the password. But the password is composed of elements of the MAC address and the device ID, both which are already transmitted without encryption, since only the password is encrypted. And that encryption uses a preset knowable static key. They informed Wemo 6 months ago. Nothing has changed. So no traction from the vendor. There's a light bulb called the LIFX bulb that they also looked at. Bitdefender found that its hotspot function suffered from insufficient authorization and authentication when setting up this mood effect bulb, as they called it, a temporary, in quotes, bootstrap hotspot is created to manage the initial configuration with the phone. But the problem is that you can later create, anyone can later create an identical fake bootstrap hotspot, which then allows a hacker to capture the username and password of the main actual Wi-Fi network that the bootstrap hotspot was only there to allow you to establish. So the idea is that the way this works is that you have an existing Wi-Fi network, and this LIFX bulb wants to get onto the main network. So what it does is it establishes a bootstrap open Wi-Fi network that your phone can see, and then you use that to tell it to identify the main network that it wants to get on. You give it your username and password, and you use this bootstrap hotspot to communicate to it, because of course it has no like mouse and keyboard and screen and so forth. Problem is, anybody can come along later, bring up that bootstrap hotspot, and query it for the username and password. Not good. Once again, after 6 months of having been notified of the vulnerability, its manufacturer has taken no action. There's something called the Link Hub, which is a GE product. The GE Link Light Bulb Hub is used for remote control lighting, lacks any transport encryption when configuring through the hotspot, so the data is transmitted in clear text. And once again, after 6 months, no activity. The fourth thing that Bitdefender looked at seemed a little better. There's something called the Muzo Cobblestone Audio Receiver, which did fare slightly better than the others in that some of its vulnerabilities were repaired after Bitdefender notified its manufacturer. However, the initial issue was scary, and even after it was fixed, there is still a problem. So the device created a new Wi-Fi hotspot that was never disabled. So again, this is this problem of how do you bootstrap these things onto the network? And it's funny because I had my best friend set up a Wemo, and he said, "Oh yeah, it was so easy to set up," and I'm like, "Okay, well, how did you get it on your Wi-Fi network exactly?" And he said, oh, you know, I just used my smartphone and gave it my Wi-Fi password. I'd never looked at this process, but it seemed to me this was a chicken and egg problem, because how could he give it his Wi-Fi password if it didn't know his Wi-Fi password, because it wouldn't be on his Wi-Fi. Now I understand these devices set up an open, unauthenticated, temporary hotspot, which the phone, you know, probably called Wemo or something, which the phone then gets on, and that's how you communicate with it. Unfortunately, it's that feature is like still there. These things don't shut it down. They probably, because they're worried, oh, what if you change your Wi-Fi password, then you're going to have to get back on the hotspot. So they're creating insecure hotspots, which are inherently linked through them to your main secure network, making them insecure. And in fact, in the case of this Muzo cobblestone audio receiver, believe it or not, it never shuts down its hotspot and runs an open telnet service with the user ID of admin and password of admin statically present, which allows open access to the household's original Wi-Fi network, bypassing any need for credentials.
Well, so, some time.
Unfortunately, that's a snapshot of the state of the art of IoT devices. We can't say that they're all a problem, but the huge majority of them really do seem to be a problem. Taking a meta view, stepping back from the details a bit, these first generation IoT devices are trying to do the impossible. They're pretending to be a limited use, purpose specific appliance, with at the same time having all the sophisticated communications and connectivity power of a general purpose computer hidden inside. But they're also trying not to present any of the responsibility baggage that all of our experience has taught us necessarily comes along with any powerful, connected, general-purpose computer. And in fact, at the beginning of their report that we will cover in more detail next week in part two of this, Rapid7 put it perfectly. They said, for our purposes, we can think of a thing with internet as simply any device, regardless of size, use, or form factor, that contains a CPU and memory, runs software, and has a network interface which allows it to communicate to other devices, usually as a client, sometimes as a server. In addition, these things tend not to resemble traditional computers. They lack a typical keyboard and mouse interface, and they often have a user interface not centered around a monitor or other text-filled screen. Finally, these devices are marketed and treated as if they are single-purpose devices rather than the general-purpose computers they actually are. This last distinction is often the most dangerous one to make when it comes to deploying Internet of Things devices. In his keynote address to the Chaos Computer Club titled Lockdown, The Coming War on General Purpose Computing, Cory Doctorow makes the case that with today's technology and current computer science thinking, we cannot yet create a computer that is anything other than general purpose. End users may have devices that are nominally prohibited from performing certain actions according to the manufacturer. And those manufacturers sometimes go to great length to foil modification efforts. In the end, though, it is not possible to build and sell a computing device that cannot be coerced into rebelling against a manufacturer's intentions. And so my own take is any system based upon a stored program must be able to have that program changed when bugs and security vulnerabilities are found. We all want that. We need them to be fixable. But that same need for the ware to be soft inherently opens the device to abuse. So next week, we'll look at some details of what Rapid7 found when they look closely at baby monitors. And boy, I know that our listeners will find it really fascinating.
Sounds like it's going to be worse than that, even.
Oh.
IoT, it's in its infancy. And, well, if you want to know a way, I guess, to use IoT, Steve has in the past described a more secure way. You don't want to put it on your give it access to your own network.
Everything we are learning says, I mean, you absolutely have to create a securely segmented network.
Is where, a guest network sufficient? Problem is, then it's not really on your network, which makes another issue.
You know? Right. That's a problem too.
Yeah.
We will show next week how anybody with a baby monitor, if any of these that Rapid7 looked at, I mean the horrifying insecurity and the horrifying lack of care that the manufacturers have. What we see are companies producing feature-laden monitors that are virtually devoid of security, meaning that anywhere, anyone in the world can be looking at your baby sleeping or wherever you have aimed this camera. I mean, they're just... It's horrifying. And they don't care. They're selling functionality. They're not selling security. And they all say, oh, you know, encryption this and secure that. And it's just nonsense. But the buyer doesn't know. They just say, oh, look, it said it's secure. Okay, click here and purchase. So there... The vulnerability is not that it, I mean, you don't want it on your network, certainly, because Lord knows if it's got an exposed Telnet server that anybody can log into elsewhere in the world using admin and admin as a username and password, you don't want that on your network, but you really don't want it exposed to the internet at all.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And I'm still just for an update. No, I think you nailed it. So this is what happened to you. It gets to a certain point, and then it just switches the drivers.
Correct.
And it says, I can't read that key anymore.
Correct.
And, of course, I don't have any USB 2 ports on this thing or any other kind of legacy way of doing it. So
right.
Yeah.
Right.
All right.
Exactly.
But it's locked down. See? We can't have it both ways. All right.
Okay. So for anyone who's not interested in sleep, you can hit stop now. I would just need to briefly tell all of the people who have been following along what's going on. As I mentioned before, okay, one of the key ingredients of my healthy sleep formula is Seraphos, which was the trade name of something called... serine phosphate produced by a company called Interplexus. As everyone knows, they who have been following this, several months ago, coincident, unfortunately, with my going public with the Healthy Sleep Formula, which I don't have a sense for how many people we've helped, but, you know, lots. The Interplexus company decided to discontinue their old formula. Unfortunately, the new formula doesn't work. And so what I did, I guess it was maybe a week ago, as soon as the new one came out and reports surfaced that it wasn't working, was I put up a review on Amazon to warn people that this new one was changed, and that anyone, the problem was there were like some 208 glowing 5-star reviews on the how fabulous Seraphos was. Unfortunately, unless people were warned, they would be purchasing the new Seraphos believing it was the old one. So I just wanted people to say, I wanted to alert people that the formula was changed. Well, Interplexus was not happy with me. And I received a phone call last Friday from France, where the medical director of Interplexus was traveling to express his unhappiness. And I got harangued for an hour by this guy trying to tell me how pure the ingredients were and that they bought the best possible components and minerals from Germany, and this new formulation was, you know, incredibly high quality. And I said, yes, that's very nice, but it no longer works. And he apparently didn't care that it no longer worked. He just was focused on how high quality the new ingredients were. So I was like, well, okay, sir, I'm sorry. Anyway, so I updated my review to tell everybody how good the new ingredients were, in fairness to him, but also that it unfortunately appeared to no longer work. Make up your own mind, but I have to go find some other solution. So I tracked down the people who make Enerphos. Enerphos. The bad news is, the moment I posted that news on that, like maybe this was going to be a replacement, they sold out all over the internet. No, you couldn't get it anymore. So same problem again. I found them and I told them that, and I also talked to the chemist, who was the originator of Seraphos. He's the guy that created the original Seraphos and was supplying it to Interplexus for quite a while until there was some falling out and they went their own ways. So this morning I got an email from the company that makes Enerphos. Cheryl, who is the one of the executives, said, it was good to talk with you last week. Thank you for reaching out to us and giving us a heads up on the new demand we can expect for Enerphos. Brian worked all weekend making more. I'm literally making it. And so she said, we have a few hundred bottles en route to Emerson now and expect to be able to ship more by Friday. We'll keep you informed of our shipments to our suppliers so you can keep us updated on the feedback you get from your readers. Thank you again for your thoughtfulness in contacting us directly. And of course, it was self-serving because, you know, I would like people who are interested in the Healthy Sleep Formula to be able to get the components of it. So on the Healthy Sleep Formula site or page, you know, just Google Healthy Sleep Formula, is a link to Emerson. Emerson is one of their larger suppliers, and right now it's backordered. But so but they're in the process of getting more stock. So if anyone is waiting for Enerfos, the thing to do would be to backorder it. And I'm sure that this Emerson Ecologics is the name of the company, will ship it when they can. Now, I should say, I haven't yet made my own determination about Enerfos as opposed to Seraphos. It just takes time. I've been working on this since last October, and I only went public with it recently. And there's, it's changed a lot of people's lives. And now the problem, of course, is that we can no longer get the Seraphos that I based this healthy, like a lot of this formula was based on. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I need to see whether Enerfos is a replacement. And if it's not, then at least I know who invented the original Seraphos. And maybe I could say, hey, Brian, can you make some of the original stuff for us? Because we need that. Anyway, that's where we are.
I can see it's not long before you start to grind your own phosphatidylserum in a mill in the back of your garage and start making this Steve's Numinos.
Well, I love that this guy and company, they're in Fresno, and he made a bunch over the weekend because we need more. So that's nice.
This is starting to sound a little weird. I'll be honest with you, Steve. Just a disclaimer, Steve's not a physician. Consult your physician before taking any supplements. And if you want to know more, grc.com. And I got nothing to do with this one. This is all you and the Seraphos family. Okay. What is it supposed to be, actually? I mean, is it actually a formulation of a variety of things, like a secret formula? Or
okay, so there is a great question. There is a molecule called phosphatidylserine, which is a so-called phospholipid. What that really means is that it's a long molecule that it's got phosphorus in it, and attached to one end is something else. In this case, serine, and attached to the other side of the phosphorus is a glycine molecule to which two long lipid tails, actually DHA, decosohexanoic acid, are attached. And that, so this is a very long molecule, and you can get phosphatidylserine on the market. The problem is that because it's so big, it isn't well absorbed. But it's very good for us. It increases cellular membrane fluidity. That is the actual fluidity of our neural cells so that they're able to pass stuff in and out more easily. And it turns out that it increases the sensitivity of our brain to cortisol. And so by increasing its sensitivity to cortisol, our brain senses the cortisol in our blood better and thus requests less of it from our adrenal glands. And that's the mechanism by which it reduces this main stress hormone, which is one of the mechanisms that we use that the Healthy Sleep Formula uses for producing better sleep. The other is that phosphatidylserine helps GABA get into our brain through the blood-brain barrier to relax our brain. But phosphatidylserine is not well absorbed, because one of the things that we learn when you're like following the whole supplement thing is it's not what you take, it's what you absorb that matters. And so serine phosphate is just sort of the head of the whole phosphatidylserine. It's the serine, the phosphate, and then what's attached to it, instead of glycine and two big long phospholipid tails or fatty acid tails, rather, is just something small like magnesium and calcium. And so what that means is it's a much lighter weight molecule, much better absorbed. And so that gets into our bloodstream, and then our bodies attach the lipid, the fatty acid tails to the serine phosphate head in order to turn into phosphatidylserine. So it ends up being phosphatidylserine inside of us, but not when we take it. So anyway, yes, biochemistry 101.
It's just, I mean, the only thing that worries me is some guy in his garage in Fresno, and this is a completely unregulated industry. So who knows what he's, I mean, doing. You don't really kind of know exactly what you're getting. There's no, there's nobody overseeing this at all, right?
That's true. And actually, this is a snapshot, though, into the supplement industry.
Yeah, no kidding.
And all I would say in defense is that the number one cause of liver failure and liver transplants in the UK, of course, is Tylenol.
Yeah, which I don't take either.
So, yeah.
And it's regulated, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, of course, pharmaceuticals are causing all kinds of problems right. for people. So, right. yep.
Anyway,
a dozen of the other.
GRC.com is a place to get more on that. Of course, Squirrel, the perfect paper passwords, and SpinRite, the world's finest hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. Plus, this show. Steve has audio of the show and beautifully written transcripts as well. It's all there. Do you ever document somewhere? Is it on the website, the build, your computer build, and what you put into it? A lot of people are asking me about it.
I know. No, I haven't. It's just a matter of time, Leo. I would like to, but...
Take some pictures. Sort of... This is where crowdsourcing would be so great. If you like it, take some pictures and say, tag these parts. And people would do it. They would figure it out. And that, I don't know. Just a thought. But we'll find out, I'm sure, at some point. One of many things. It's such a great site, full of lots of information. GRC.com. We do the show every Tuesday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. Please tune in live. Join us in the chat room. If you have questions for Steve, I guess we're going to finish IoT up next week.
We're going to do part two of IoT infancy.
And we'll do questions the week following.
Yeah. And I have to say, of the big monster box I built, the reason I'm uncomfortable is that it's not something I could recommend. Like, for example, I chose a what was the name? It was not Asus. Gigabyte.
Oh, Gigabyte motherboard. That's right.
But
yeah.
I don't know that it was the right one or the right. best one. And I kind of had to fight with it in order to get, right. you know, I wanted to run 128 gig of RAM. I could only run 64, but I could run 128 if I slowed it down. So I don't want to recommend right. something that right. I don't really know and I haven't really believed in. So, right. Right. you know, once upon a time, Steve's Dream Machine was a result of, you know, really knowing there's no better solution for every single one of these components than what I chose. I just don't know that, you know, for this. This works, and I fought with it for a while to, you know, to make it what I wanted, but I couldn't ever represent that it's, like, the best solution.
That makes sense. It's just something you chose. But, you know yeah. your fans. They want to do whatever you did. They figure it's going to be better than whatever they do. Anyway.
You make a good point. I chopped intelligently.
Yeah, you make a good point. Let's see. I mentioned, you can get on-demand audio and video of the show, not only at twit.tv/SN, but every single podcatcher all the world round. Just choose one, subscribe, so you get every week.
Because we've been there from day one.
Day one. And at leolaporte.com/blog, there is an entry with three scripts that allow you to, with some modification, download every episode of Security Now. Should you want to build your collection, I put those on my blog. Three different fans had written scripts in PowerShell and Python and Bash, I think, something like that.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's at leolaporte.com/blog. Thank you, Steve. We'll see you next week.
Hey, my friend. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Security.